Today in the Science and Spirituality podcast, we interviewed Dr. Nicole Tatro. So a quick bio on her. She received her PhD from California Institute of Technology and is a compassionate neuroscientist, author, meditation teacher, and international speaker on topics of neurodiversity, human development, creativity, mental health, and wellness. Her book, Insight into a Bright Mind, explores groundbreaking research examining the experiences of unique, creative, and intense brains through interviews, storytelling, and literary science, while advocating for new directions of human diversity and neurodiversity. Nicole also has authored numerous academic papers on intelligence, autism, brain evolution, neuroinflammation, and behavior. She's the founder of Awesome Neuroscience, and she communicates the most promising neuroscience and positive psychology for people to wire their brains for love. So it's a credible interview we had with her. And there were so many topics we touched on, which were really brilliant. And Chris, I actually want you to share something you shared at the very, very end. Like actually it was after we hit pause in the recording about like how this will really set people free.
Well, yeah, I was going to say, I think this podcast will set a lot of people free because we talk about neurodiversity and just how, you know, growing up in America, a lot of people are trying to fit into this specific system that they've been told you have to fit into. And if you don't, like, you're either not successful or you're not smart or there's something wrong with you. And it's like understanding that all of us have different types of brains and process information and learn things in different ways and have different interests. It's really like setting yourself up to fail if you compare yourself to those things for a lot of people. And so understanding neurodiversity and how you could be different, how you could think different could really like, you know, set you free because you can be like, wow, I have different strengths and I have different things that I'm good at and I don't have to fit into this box. And so we get into that a lot on this podcast and it's just really great, really good podcast.
Definitely. And I will say, just to add one thing to that, I have a feeling it's not just America though. Like, I mean, we don't have the personal lived experience of that, but I feel like it's most developed countries have this problem. Maybe just honestly, pretty much anywhere in the world, I feel like it's the same because neurodiversity and neurodivergence, like I think you actually mentioned somewhere in this podcast that like it's only in the last like 30, 40 years where we really started to understand it. So like, I think it's everywhere. So again, could really set people free, not just in America, but although that is what we talk about because obviously the three of us are living in America.
Yeah. And we halfway through the podcast, we also start talking about how this relates to relationships too. And I think that was a really important piece.
Definitely.
Again, understanding if you think different and people you care about and interact with think different. It's like it really helps with relationships.
Yep. So enjoy the episode.
Welcome to the Science and Spirituality Podcast, where we dive deep into universal spiritual principles and ground them in modern science. My name is Chris Carton.
And my name is Kevin Carton. And we are committed to simplifying the spiritual side of success for you with easy to understand scientific research so you can walk away with practical tools to create radical transformations in your life. Let's get started.
So welcome to the podcast, Nicole.
Thanks for having me. What a pleasure to be here with you both.
Ditto. And looking forward to this conversation on neurodivergence, because just as we were saying before we hit record, we have not had an episode yet out of 200 plus episodes on our podcast about neurodivergence. So very excited for this. So let's begin with you sharing your story, how you got into neuroscience, how you got into getting your PhD and all of that, so that you're on this path. And also now we've got a book. So tell us your story.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things. I think you both, all three of us, have a lot of similarities. I think when people tell us we can't do things, that's the go ahead that I'm going to do this. And so in my case, it really came down to when I was 18, my mom was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, which is a neurodegenerative disease. And it's a really, it starts out as a physical disease where there's either akinesia, where people can't move, or there's tremors. And for my mother, it took her about 3 years for her diagnoses. Going in and out of doctors because she had very unconventional symptoms. She also had a lot of mental health considerations that went along with the disease that really aren't addressed. That includes like anxiety that really starts out, because all of a sudden your will to use your body in the way that you used to causes that fight or flight, right? And then on top of it, there's depression, because there's this, why is this happening? Like not knowing. And so really for me, what happened was we were in the doctor, the standard office, and the doctor had said to my mother and myself, you have Parkinson's, get your affairs in order, you have 10 years. And I was like, what? And I'm like, there isn't anything you could do in terms of diet and exercise for this. And no, it's neurodegenerative, forget it. And so for me, I was like, you're wrong. You've got to be wrong. And that really catapulted me to get a PhD in neuroscience and really understand what was happening in the brain. And more importantly, I knew, you know, I was a runner, I knew what diet did, you know, and so I knew that there were these things intrinsically, like you just know when your body feels right, your mental state feels right. So on top of that, when I went to grad school, you know, 2 years later, USC neuroscientists showed exercise improves symptoms of Parkinson's, you know, and then it went on, like now we know the gut microbiome has such a strong interaction with the interface with a lot of neurodegenerative disorders. So that was really what spearheaded me, was to say, no, this model isn't working. And then even further, kind of what got me really into meditation now, which is what I'm really centered on, even though we're going to talk a lot about neurodivergence. My son was identified as gifted, but then there was this dual complexity of what was going on. Simultaneously, when I was in an undergrad at UC Davis, I was diagnosed with dyslexia. And so I went all through school without ever being known that I had dyslexia. And there was a lot that was really different about my experience and my processing. You know, I think in stories, I remember auditory information very well, but visually it was a challenge, you know, for memorization. And so once I, for myself, learned how to study, I went from getting C's to A's. And so it made a really big difference. And then also there was this sort of stereotype being a blonde female, and that I kind of came up against with that in terms of my neurodivergence. And so there was that kind of interplay. And then on top of it, when my son was identified, I really knew as a parent, I had to think about the way I parented him really differently. You know, there's a snippet in my book where I talk about, I was at a parent teacher conference. He was in second grade, identified reading at grade level, you know, he was reading at college level. And at the same time, he didn't really love playing outside with other kids. He loved going to the library and reading and being with teachers. And I was like, what's going to happen to his social development? And I was really concerned, like there was something I needed to fix. And he said, no, I just need to take a break and be by myself. And I was like, oh. And the teacher said, he's already self-regulating. There isn't anything you need to do. And so that was really the doorway into thinking about neurodivergence, where we need to talk to our children and see how they can guide us, because they really know what they need. And we have these social constructs and these models of how we should be. And that kind of really spearheaded that. And simultaneously, you know, as my mother passed away, I was really struggling with the limitations that science had for me in terms of answers. And so that really led me into about 2003, before she passed, you know, she passed in 2013, but I started really studying meditation and practicing and seeing how really these ancient practices opened my mind to manage and deal with suffering and to deal with the grief and the loss and these feelings of anxiety and depression that go along with losing someone that you love in the baseline. So that's kind of the fusion of a lot of different pieces.
Wow. And honestly, the word that kept coming to my mind after each of these pieces of the story that you shared is like, it seemed like you were put into like a pressure cooker of discovering like what is neurodivergence and how do we deal with it? How do we work with it in a different way than the current paradigm is for most of the world?
Yeah. And I mean, I think the problem is too, is it's 1 in 5 people that are identified, but then that's not even. And so to really quickly identify what neurodivergence is and what we're talking about is really different brain wirings that occur where people have different behaviors and reactions. And so that flows in like an umbrella of identifications. And I like that a lot better than the word diagnosis, right? Mm, identification yeah. is really different. And when we think about that, that's ADHD, autism spectrum, sensory processing, dyspraxia, dyslexia, dyscalculia. So all these disses, right? Where people seem to be missing things. Right. They really have great brain wiring for other types of way that maybe right. school may not show.
Yep. That just sparked a thought. I have a mastermind partner who lives in New Zealand that is, he's a paraplegic. And he has a main talk he has. He's a coach himself. And he says, instead of being disabled, he's otherly abled.
Yeah.
Oh. It's such a beautiful way of thinking of it differently. It's like, it's just because our words are so powerful. They're literally vibrations that carry a meaning. And when we, like you said, I use the word dis, it's like, oh, like there's something wrong. It's like, yeah. Is there? Especially in neurodivergence.
Yeah. And we know there's so many strengths, like your partner right. who's the paraplegic, like he could think about using his mind and body in different ways than we can ever even think of in terms of, you know, our accessibility. Exactly. And I think, yeah, he'd be a great person. I bet you've had him on your podcast.
Yes, we have. It was actually a couple of years ago. Well, Chris, that's a great reminder because he asked to be on the podcast again. He said, yes, we just haven't talked about the time yet to schedule him. So anyway, thanks for that callback. But but yeah, so I'm curious then, what spans like most of your work then? Like, I know that you've got your book, obviously, like in terms of just like how you help people. I know you said also meditation, like, I'm sure there's 1,000 different ways we can go in this conversation, but I'm curious of like what steps you've been taking in your work to support people with this kind of neurodivergence.
Well, I think what you said was really important when we think about language. So for me, the book was really a spearhead for us to think about this and talk about this in really different ways. And to think about the strengths that each type of brain has and what we have to offer. And so with my work, what I like to do and what I'm doing now as I speak, I also have a study guide that's actually coming out in 2024 related to the book for advocacy. And so that's a lot what I do, teachings and trainings for corporations. And then with my meditation work, really, you know, it's kind of more geared toward if corporations want that, you know, it gets a little, you get a little woo-woo. But then it's, you know, doing retreats and kind of people who want to get a little bit deeper into their practice and work on these things together.
Yeah. Nice. I wonder, do they go together often? I mean,
they do. Imagine,
but
yeah. I mean, I think, you know, like for example, when I've spoken to people at American Express or something, you know, it's like you could slide in a meditation in there, you know, which is sort of something that they can use later. And, you know, you could see like there's somebody who may be sitting there and this is like a nightmare to be in their body. And then you see somebody else who's like having tears and like, I forgot I'm an artist. Thank you for that, you know, and I'm going to start doing art. And so, you know, I think with like my background in training, you know, a lot of it, you know, for that aspect, it's a little bit easier because when you can talk about the science, people could really access that, right? Like I think both you know that in your work and what you do, that the science gives somebody a foundation. And then if that foundation kind of opens up in the mind, the goal is let's get into our heart, right?
Yes.
You know, and get out of this thinking mode. And so that's where the meditation comes in. And so Another aspect is I'm kind of designing school programs for educators and kids that are neurodivergent. So, you know, not sitting on a cushion, but let's go take an awe walk. You know, let's listen to sounds. So kind of what are the different ways we can explore tuning into our awareness?
That's like such important work. Cause I mean, I know a bunch of people, and it's funny because growing up, I didn't have a concept of what someone who was neurodivergent would be. Like I wasn't thinking in those terms, but you know, my fiance, like her and her brother, like they have like some neurodivergencies, and we actually talk about this a lot. So it's really interesting to have you on the podcast, because the last couple of years is really the first time I heard that term, neurodivergence. And so are you seeing like a lot of reception in schools and stuff, like they actually want to like start learning more about this and implementing these kind of programs to help these other kids succeed in their own way? Or is it been kind of difficult?
I think it's a both and, you know, I think there's a lot of people who are open-minded to, especially parents that see it in their children, and then educators who see it in their classroom who are tapped into that. The challenge we come up against, I think, in standard education is money. You know, I mean, I think the first problem is educators are nowhere near paid enough, you know, for taking care of 30 minds every single day. You know, I met an educator the other day. She has over 1,000 students that she teaches art to at a high school, you know, by the time of the end of the year. And so when you're thinking about that, I think the real challenge is that so much of our funding gets cut, where for kids that are neurodivergent, you know, things that are in the arts like music and, you know, having visual arts, having theater and things like that are such a doorway for them to develop their natural strengths. You know, like people wouldn't even begin to understand, but some kids that are on the autism spectrum tend to actually be really good at theater because they can memorize lines really well. And when they're trained in social cues and expressions, they can do it almost identical because it's the way their brain is wired. And so, but you wouldn't know that. And then also you could have children who are struggling with trauma, and music could be a really good doorway for, you know, not even them knowing how these frequencies and vibrations are naturally healing them. And so it's, I think the real challenge is that we're so forced in our society where academic achievement and the term giftedness are so intertwined that there's so many misconceptions of what it looks like to have a healthy, holistic child who naturally develops that's not based on the model of getting straight A's and the achievement piece to be going to Harvard or something like that. Like, you know, what if your kid is really happy and they want to go to University of Colorado and hike every day and be outdoors? And so I think that, you know, the receptivity piece is, it's a double-edged sword. And I think also what people don't know, they're afraid of, right? So if we change the system, there's going to be a lot of chaos at first to know how to balance this out. But for example, I teach at a graduate school called Bridges Graduate School in Cognitive Diversity, where I'm designing these programs for kids. And they have a lower and a middle school, and one is in Seattle, one is in California. And they really have this strength-based approach, and they have a very different educational system. So for example, a standard classroom has 40 minutes. Their periods go for 80 minutes. So kids could take a real deep dive. There's the awareness to train kids, because when you have, for example, a child who may have ADHD, they could have this deep hyper-focus and they may need time for transition. Because if you're in flow, right, like any of us, if we're in flow and I'm saying, get off of that, stop listening to this, all of a sudden your dopamine is going to crash and you're going to have behavior that's going to be out of sync, right? You're going to have frustration and anger. And so if you teach children the transition, then they can fluidly move to the next thing. And so what they're finding is through this model of the strength-based teaching, which has really been developed by Dr. Susan Baum, that they find that the success of children finding their place and that positive natural brain growth that we're talking about, this neuroplasticity that's available to all of us, those connections happen a lot sooner rather than that delay. And we know, I'm going to add, sorry, I keep going, that, you know, you guys probably already know this, but during adolescence, there's this massive brain growth happening. And so we need to build in the strengths naturally. So it was long-winded, sorry.
Yeah. Love the long-winded answers.
But there's a lot of pieces to it though. So that, I mean, it makes so much sense. It's like, you know, growing up for me, like I always felt that school came easy to me. And I almost thought that that was just how everyone's experience was. But it's like, you know, my fiance, for example, like, because she has ADHD and like just the learning style of the classroom just didn't fit with her style. And so like, there's a lot of times where she was growing up, she's like, oh, I just felt dumb. But she's not, it's just like different skills. And so it's like trying to fit everyone into a specific box that our education system has designed. And if you fit into it, great, you're going to do well. But if you don't, it's like, there's really no place for those people, even though there's really nothing wrong with them. It's just, they have a different style of learning, a different brain type. And so it's just, I think that's the challenge. It's like being able to train people and then also being able to design a system that works for everybody.
Yeah. And in her case, like, did she feel like, and the other thing too, is that when that system doesn't work, you have a higher rate of people falling out of it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And they're not in their natural gifts. And so for her now, has she felt like she found her rhythm and knows she's smart?
Yeah, no, I think it was also just her getting the education for herself too, being like, oh, like this is how my brain works and this is why certain things are difficult and this is why I'm better at certain things. So it was like not having that knowledge and not having that identification growing up as that type of person, it harmed her because it's like she thought that she should be fitting into this and didn't really understand like, okay, this is my brain type. And I think a lot of people probably fall into that too if they're not getting educated on this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And it's really, there's that level of trauma you're talking about, like mm-hmm. educational trauma, and also trauma of just even feeling like you fit in society, right? Yeah. Feeling other and not really understanding why. And I think that's really what the goal is for this shift.
Yeah. And
go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, like, I don't know what type of research that you have been doing on this in terms of like a macro perspective, but are there more and more people that are being identified as neurodiverse lately, or do you think it's always been a thing throughout history? It's just, it has like, we didn't have the awareness of it until 30, 40 years ago. And now we're like, okay, a lot of people are actually like this.
That's a great question. So like when you think about it and they kind of look back, they say Einstein was neurodiverse. They say, you know, they say Leonardo da Vinci was, like he visually saw things different. You know, when you even think about the story of Helen Keller. And so when we think about it, I think it's of both, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there's the awareness now in our society. I also think that there are these co-occurrences that have happened, which you would know about a lot with both of your work, when you're thinking about how our environment has changed our genetics, like just epigenetic factors. And evolutionarily, you know, for example, when you even think about a brain, let's quote unquote, and I like to say attention divergent giftedness instead of a deficit, but it's divergent thinking. That you would have thought that somebody who has that kind of macro picture, because that's really what somebody can do with that type of brain, they can really see. So they may have been the people who kept everyone safe at night, you know, to ensure like tigers or other tribes weren't entering into the areas, and they kind of had that wiring as protection. And so I think there's like the adaptation of our brains a little bit, that in our system of now we sit in front of computers or even sitting in a desk, you know, when you think about it, you know, there's this one picture I have in one of my lectures where it's like kids in the 1950s when they really started with that, or even it was the 30s, where they really started with that, you know, education, educate all equally. Everybody's child's face is long, you know, it's just a sad, sad face. And if you're told like you have to sit, you know, if you think about that at that time where kids were getting hit with rulers, you know, if they were moving or doing something like what that's going to do to their experience. So I think that it's our awareness, you know, I think it's always been there. And I also think that we have changed, you know, as a species in a lot of way and how we operate in the world. You know, we don't go out and use our bodies nearly enough of what we're built to be doing. And so I think that's where all these illnesses can come up as well, because we're not clearing these energies that get stuck. So I think it's, and when I say energy is getting stuck, is the idea that you're forcing a child who has ADHD to sit still. That's going to be something that's going to eventually harm their nervous system. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be disadvantageous. And not only their physical, but it's their mental, emotional, and even their thought process, where they're going to, you know, so I think it's, and if you're not allowing that kid, you know, if you have a kid who needs to just get up and run around the classroom, let him, not around the classroom, but maybe outside for a minute, right? Like, go get those butterflies out.
Yeah, I forgot where I read this. I think it might have been a holistic book that I was reading. And he was saying, this doctor, he was a chiropractic doctor, I believe, and he was saying that for kids like healthy brain development, like they need to move like something like 6 miles a day. It's like they need to be running around, they need to be moving. And like if you think about some kids now, especially if the, you know, in the school year, they're sitting so much of the time, and it's like for that healthy brain development, they actually need to be moving around and like touching the grass and like, you know, testing the boundaries of like their physical like natures to help build their nervous systems and their brains. And it's not happening as much as it used to. So that was a point I wanted to bring up. And then another thing that you were talking about with the evolutionary, you know, back when we were hunter gatherers or whatever, in some of my discussions with my fiance about this, she was mentioning that she read somewhere about back then, like hunters in tribes would often be like probably like ADHD or neurodivergent and have this ability to like focus on like the horizon or focus on like seeing an animal and like chasing it down. And so like those skills that often now are kind of not looked down on, but just not understood by society, probably were very revered back then for a bunch of other different reasons that we just kind of forgot about today.
Yeah. Or don't even let in. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Nicole, I want to bring us back to something that you said earlier. It's been just like a key in my mind. I'm like, I want to ask you about this because you said something very briefly, but I would love for you to unpack this, that when you're talking about the classroom and how kids learn and the amount of time that in that particular school, that's like 80 minutes for deep dive. But then you said something interesting about transition, like giving space for transition. And that stuck in my mind because not only for myself and my business, but also I know with my clients and many people that in terms of work or just because I'm thinking of like a listener who's like really resonating with this whole conversation, but it's like, how can I apply this to me? I'm curious if there is a connection point of like, you know, for kids it's that way, but maybe some adults as well, of like, how do you, or what's the process of giving yourself that time to focus, but then also like, what is that transition period? I'm very curious to hear more about that transition you were talking about.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think for everybody, we need transitions. And I think that's why so much of what we see for emotional, I would say, out of syncness or dysregulation we experience is that we're so deep in flow in something, like say our work day. Like, let me give you an example. It's going to be kind of a bigger example, but, you know, I was once at a retreat and somebody asked the main teacher, they said, you know, for me, my husband, I cook dinner every night and he's 2 hours late every night. working. And it was causing a lot of conflict in their relationship because she felt he wasn't respecting the time period for dinner, and she was offering this meal and they couldn't even enjoy it. And so every time there was an argument. And what it came down to is, in his mind, he was really looking to be the provider and feel that he needed to make money for the food. And so it was really this disconnect that was happening in the relationship, that both of the core actions that they were creating for each other came from a basis of love, but the expectation and timing was really out of sync. And so there was this disconnect in terms of what love looks like, right? And so when we think about that on kind of more of a meta level, is the awareness that, you know, a couple of things with an expectation. First, it needs to be understood. Second, somebody needs to be bodied and abled. And then the third thing, a person needs to be willing. And in that transition period, you have to kind of think about, if somebody's in that deep dopamine flow state, that transition is going to be really hard. And to break out of that, you know, you kind of have the social, emotional, physical awareness kind of happening. So another example, like to kind of even think about, you know, for example, when I cook dinner for my son, you know, he'll be in flow playing video games. Right. And if he's playing video games, you know, I'm like, you have 20 minutes. And like, sometimes he's in the middle of a game and he can't just drop out. Right. Cause it's social. There's a group. And so I've learned to say, okay, you're in that. And when we kind of have that agreement that, okay, both needs can be met simultaneously, where there can be kind of a buffer around it. You know, I think a lot probably with your clients, they may come from very high stress jobs where they're in this fight or flight, having to get things done. And then what happens when you go home? Everybody wants to like take their work clothes off, take off the tight clothes, be relaxed. And at the same time, there's the roles and the expectations of what it is to be a caretaker in a household. And so the brain needs time to shift in and out of these sort of roles that we've created. And our roles change, right? Like my role when my son was 5 years old is very different now that he's 19. And it's a very different role that I take on. And it's almost, and so I think when you're thinking about working with your clients, one kind of doorway into this is kind of helping them identify their roles, and then like the list of expectations or experiences that they have in those roles. And then from one activity to another, what is something they could do for themselves in between that transition from work to home, or dropping the kids off to school into work? What's something they could do in that amount of time to nurture their soul, right? Not that role, but nurture that soul. Like, is it, you know, listening to a meditation while they're driving? Is it listening to their favorite rock song? You know, is it dropping their bags when they get home and taking a 5, 10, 15 minute walk, you know, before they get in and see everybody? And so it's sort of that. So that's kind of when I talk about transitions, is that it's coming into that awareness of what you need, you know, and also in relation to other people, giving them a buffer and yourself a buffer. Like, you know, when I think about kids, for example, who are neurodiverse, I'm sorry, this is so long, but it makes me think about, you know, in California, I don't know where you're at, but we have these blowers for for gardeners. And these blowers can cause a physiological response where somebody's nervous system goes haywire, you know, and it feels like a threat. And you both know this, but when something is a sensory perception that touches on the element of pain, it's called nociception, right? That triggers that nervous system response. So you could get a child who's completely dysregulated, an adult, right? And so you have to figure out, okay, how do I pull that trigger out of their awareness? And how do we shift? And to recognize that, you know, you may need earplugs, you may need this, but also there's that time to kind of allow that nervous system to come back to baseline where it's not hyper aroused.
Yeah, that's like really good advice. I have a question. I guess I'll just preface it by saying that it sounds like understanding people around you and their neurodiversities can really help with relationships, right? Because understanding what someone might be triggered by, and if you don't have that understanding, then you could think that they're maybe ignoring you or whatever, but really they're just kind of in their heads trying to self-regulate because something's happening around them. So and I guess everyone can relate to this on this call. This podcast, because everyone probably knows someone who is neurodivergent at this point, even if they're not aware of it. So how do you, I guess, have those conversations with people in your life that you care about, or even start to try to identify what you could possibly be in terms of neurodivergent and what other people around you that you have relationships with can kind of be as well? I guess just some advice on how to navigate that, because it sounds very important when it comes to relationships.
Yeah. So, I think that first and foremost is to set up that compassionate communication container, right? Where a lot what you talk about, if you're a person who's neurodiverse, a lot can be set up around saying, in my experience, I experienced something this way, which kind of really takes it off of, I experience when dinner's not happening at the time that I'm expecting, I experience frustration, not you're causing me frustration. Mm-hmm. Because it really puts somebody else on the defense. And I think with anything like this, it's vulnerability, right? Part of neurodiversity is looking at the complexities of your individual strengths. And it also is shining a light on things that are challenging for you, right? So exactly what you're saying is, being a receiver of somebody who's neurodiverse, right? In your experience, I understand maybe for you, you need extra time to transition. In my experience, it's a little hard for me to be waiting around. And so where can we meet on this? How can I understand ways? I have a very, when I wake up every morning, I usually don't like to talk to anybody for at least three to five hours. Four is ideal, but it's if I could be in silence, you can't, not all the time. This is 9 o'clock. If I did that, I'd get up at 4 a.m. So, at some point you kind of have to have that flexibility. So I think, and the other thing too is to not take things so personally. I think we take that people are doing something to us or causing something to us, and to also step back and recognize, for example, if there's a child who's screaming, that at the core of their experience, that's suffering, right? And all of us here, I think one of our biggest things is we all want to reduce suffering in the best way we can. Mm-hmm. And so when you do that, you can just say, I'm here for you. When it really comes down to it, I always come back to, with communication and hard conversations, is the work of the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh. And he has these beautiful four principles, and I'm hopefully going to remember them. The first one is I see your suffering. The second one is I'm here for your suffering. The third thing is I'm suffering too. And the fourth one is this is a happy moment. So also, even through all that suffering, to recognize that there can be always the love and the joy at the bottom of everything. Underneath everything, it is there. And if this tension wasn't arising, it wouldn't be the love that exists there, right? You're here to solve these things together. Like, karmically, we're brought together by people to learn together and work through whatever we're meant to work through in this lifetime.
Hmm. Beautifully said.
I was literally just about to say the same thing.
Yeah. It's funny too, because like I have, you know, like those experiences, like relationally, I feel that, because I just, like, a quick example, like, so like my fiance, I like to be on time. Like, I'm very, like, even early, like for me, like on time is like 10 minutes early. And my fiance, like, you know, having like ADHD, she experiences like time blindness a lot. So like in the beginning of our relationship, like before I understood, I was like, oh, why can't we be on time on places? And now it's like, now that I understand, it's more of like a conversation piece where it's like, all right, like, how can we work around this? Like, this is what, you know, I'm expecting. And like, I understand that this is what happens to you at sometimes. And it's like, because I now understand that, it's like, it just made our relationship so much better, because now I know where she's coming from, and I have an understanding of, you know, what the challenges are for her. And so, you know, that's just one example, but there's tons of other ones in our relationship. And I'm sure like other people can relate to that too, but it is, I think, important to kind of like understand, and again, be able to identify other people and like have conversations with them about these things, because it can only bring you closer in the end.
Yeah. I love that example you shared. And I also think about how time is different everywhere else, you know, like here, you know, I mean, I feel like we all agreed 9 a.m. and we were here. And it's really funny. I have an Indian chanting teacher, and pretty much every time we have a meeting, he starts about 15 minutes late. And in India, for example, like, timeline is very different than here, you know, and it's, and in that, and I think these discussions, you know, there's that awareness, like, you could tell yourself, like, okay, well, we'll be like, my father was like you. He, I'll invite him to my house. He's a half an hour early, and I'm still getting ready. And he's just happy. I get him a glass of water. He sits down, he's petting the dogs, and it kind of works out. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for the longest time, I was a nervous wreck, because I felt like I was always late, even though he's a half an hour early, yeah. You know, and it's just, it's finding that space. Do you have some time things, Kevin?
I do. But funny enough, both me and my wife are very punctual. And so that works out beautifully, because both of us are right on the same page with that. But we also know that that's not everyone's case. But then in relationship with our friends, sometimes that's where we kind of notice the frustration rise up. But you said something beautifully before that I think at a deep level, I think we all know is the truth, that these things like frustrations, anger, like misunderstanding rises up so that we can dig into the root of that love and understanding and really discover that for ourselves, and then bring that to the surface so that it's not that reaction that plays the part, like that's the humanness. But then to go to that soul level, like you mentioned, it's like karmic patterns for us to work out. I believe in my version of that, my words would be, is that that's what our soul is signed up for, to go through, so that we can not only dive deeper into love, but also express more love into this world, which is sorely needed.
Yeah. Mm.
Beautifully said. I love that.
Thanks.
Yeah, and I think another thing I wanted to highlight that you said earlier, just kind of in relation to what Kevin was talking about, was not taking things personally. That was like a big thing for me. Again, like just going back to my example in the beginning of our relationship, like with the time thing, it's like, before I understood, I was like, oh, like she's making me late. Like, this is like I was taking it more personally, because I was like, oh, I expect to be on time. But then now it's like, I don't take it personally anymore. It's just like, okay, now I understand. And it's like that understanding piece brought us closer. So it's like, it's important. And I think, again, just like the relationships that we have, we all have relationships with people who are probably neurodivergent, whether you know it or not. And so it's about like, then I think this conversation for people who've never heard of this before, it's going to be very eye-opening. Because I think they'll start looking at their friends and people that they're close with a little differently, and being like, hey, like, you know, maybe their brain does work differently than mine. And it's a very like good thing to start doing.
Which yeah. that really quick, is this, I think, want to transition to something that Chris asked before, but it was within the context of like three questions you had in one, Chris.
Yeah.
But Nicole, the one question he asked that I didn't hear from you yet that I want to hear from you is, the how do you identify, like, for yourself? Or noticing for others, like, I'm, you know, not everyone's got a PhD in neuroscience, so, and they may not go to like get quote unquote diagnosed or identified, right? So what do you have as suggestions for people to identify or see it for themselves or others?
So that's a great question. So the identifications are a little bit our deal with the devil, right? In some ways, because an identification could pigeonhole somebody. At the same time, for example, with a child who maybe has pretty severe ADHD or dyslexia, it could really be the difference that they get the right services that they need early on. And, you know, and that's kind of what, when, and that's where, you know, getting the testing and the identification matters, because, you know, you have to have a disability to get these 501(c)(3) plans, or to get anything in the classroom where something changes, where somebody could get a specialized educational plan. And so, so to do that, standardly, the public schools in California test for giftedness, I think, in fourth or fifth grade, across the band. The problem with that is that it's a test, and I've heard people who have taken it about 12 times and then are self-identified as gifted. And the problem with a standard IQ test, so this is where I talk about this a bit in my book. With a standard IQ test, what we're looking at really is executive functioning. And it was really identified for individuals who can process information rapidly and regurgitate it in these kind of multiple ways. And it's not going to capture A, all giftedness, B, you know, it doesn't account for creativity, it doesn't account for innovation, and or divergent thinking. So, and it's timed. So you could have somebody who's really brilliant, but they just need a little more time. And so that's one caveat. The second piece is, when we're thinking about identifications for, you know, dyslexia and ADHD and things like that, those really require a neuropsych evaluation. And the thing is those run price-wise privately from $1,000 all the way up to $5,000, depending. You know, standardly, they're, I would say now they're maybe 2,000. So on that, they're not available for everybody. So if you're looking at somebody who's in a lower socioeconomic status, both parents are working, the child, you know, is almost, you know, they're not gonna get the services they need. So the identifications need to really be available for all people in the our communities. You know, there shouldn't be this element to it. And then the other thing, when we think about these identifications, I do think it's important for people to have, because A, it gives us the right to help them wire their brain for the way that they naturally grow, rather than going through school suffering with a lot of misinformation, myths, and being the trouble kid. And, you know, and never feeling like they fit in. But, you know, instead of it being special ed, that they get to, you know, explore art as an extra period instead. And so, yeah. And then you asked how I personally identify. So I am dyslexic, you know, and so I tell people that all the time. Now, you wouldn't ever know that with me being a writer and the amount that I edit. But at the same time, my dyslexia is very strange. For letters like I before E, I get that mixed up all the time. Double consonants are really hard for words. I can hear languages, but new languages, spelling and writing, are very hard for me. But I can speak, but seeing letters and words, letters with words in my brain, is very hard still. And I see that because I try to go to different countries and learn new languages. And I thought, oh, this is, you know, where with English, I think I've trained my brain enough. You know, it takes a lot of training.
Yeah. I don't know if we'll have time to get into it on this podcast. So I don't know, maybe we'll have to have you back on again, but I'm just really curious about your work with corporate America and like how they're being receptive to, I guess like learning about neurodivergence and maybe with their employees and stuff. Cause I know every time I apply for a job, there's always a disability questionnaire and there's like 100 things on there. And it's like, I feel like everyone has something like anxiety, depression. It's like just these things that I feel like are normal for society that are on there. And I'm just wondering like how corporations and companies are dealing with that, or if they're actually giving people accommodations that they're supposed to. And like, do people feel comfortable telling people that they have these kind of things in a corporate environment? Like, there's just so many questions I have around that.
I think for corporate America, it's starting to come into awareness. And I think that there's a lot that needs to be unpacked. You know, I think that that when, you know, speaking, you know, right now, the doorway that I kind of use to talk through this is really through kind of emotional intelligence. You know, how do we work with one another and understand? When it comes to neurodiversity, I still think there's a lot that needs to happen in the education. You know, I think, for example, like in a place like Silicon Valley, you know, a lot of engineers and software engineers have come in that are obviously neurodiverse. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they have a lot of autonomy to work that the way that they do. So I think the way that a lot of people are working from home now has changed that, rather than it being this sort of organizational system where people are sitting at a desk that, you know, for example, if you have somebody who has auditory processing and they're at a cubicle and the person next to them is stapling all day and doing all these other things that could aggravate their nervous system, that's still, I don't think, totally in the awareness of corporate America.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. So I think we're coming up on time. I just want to see if you had anything else that you wanted to share that we might not have gotten into. And then if you also want to share like where people can find you and maybe a little bit about like your book and stuff, and we can kind of go from there.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me. People could find me at NicoleTatro.com, Awesome Neuro. It's a lot of my social media stuff. My book is Insight into a Bright Mind, and you could connect with me, you know, contact me for any sort of collaborations on Instagram or anything like that. And, you know, hopefully we can work on this all together. You know, I think the work that the two of you are doing is so foundational to help people find the space to be okay with who they are. You know, I think that's the biggest thing when I think about neurodiversity or just human diversity, period, is that underlying all of it, we're actually okay exactly as we are. There isn't anything that needs to change. We don't need to fix ourselves. We don't need that. We just need to change our thought patterns around really how okay we are. And there's one other thing I wanted to say really quick that we were talking about earlier, when we have these discordant moments with people, maybe around time or whatever it may be, is, you know, to recognize like, oh, this is happening again. And the awareness to say like, oh, this is the script that's happening again. And like, and it's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Well, beautiful. It sounds like that was a connection from like the Thich Nhat Hanh piece, like the fourth piece of like, this is a happy moment, back to that, you know, the discord you might have, but then that's an opportunity to evolve.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Nicole. It was an awesome conversation. Pleasure having you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. Yeah. It's an honor. So thank you.
And that's it for today. So thanks for tuning in. We really hope you enjoyed listening to this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. So any questions, any comments, connect with us on Instagram personally at Kevin F. Carton
or at Chris J. Carton or our podcast or Instagram page at Science and Spirituality Podcast. And if you feel guided to, the one thing that we do ask is for you to please rate the podcast and also leave a review. This way we can reach more people and in that way impact more lives. So with that, we'll see you on the next episode.